Let's talk. Talk. John Brown.
The science of racism. Polls show that over 50% of Britons in the UK don't believe that racism exists. In a world made for white people, The Science of Racism, written by Professor Keon West, uses clear scientific research to expose what we know about racism, exactly how we know it, and what we can do about it. Delighted to say that joining me live on the line now is Keon West himself. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure. Well, the pleasure's sort of all mine, though it's hardly a pleasurable subject because it forces us to look at ourselves. And I read an article that you read a couple of years ago. I think it was in The Guardian about your son's coming back and saying people that he couldn't, your son was told he couldn't be a doctor because of the color of his skin and his hair was curly, but the wrong curly. And we are used to race. We have to be on our guard because it's the insidious racism we're looking at here. It's not the guys walking through with right-wing slogans and whatever. It is the default setting for many.
Yes, I'd say so. It is the insidious racism. And I do think we have to be very, very aware of how much it is the default setting and about how early it starts. So that story you mentioned about my son, he was only about 3 at the time, and that's incredibly young. But the research shows that by the time children are 3, they're certainly both the perpetrators and the victims of racism, that 3-year-olds are definitely doing racist things and they're doing it to each other and teachers are doing it to them. And so it starts incredibly early. And it is true that there's a lot of insidious racism, a lot of sneaky racism. But I think people also underestimate how much racism is just sitting there in the open, how much people are aware of the fact that they're doing racist things, but they either rationalize it or lie about it or hide it. I think that's a number that would surprise a certain number of people.
The begs the question, why are we still here? Because we've been aware of this now since, you know, I'm born in the 60s. I remember sort of the outcry of the Rock Against Racism riots, you know, the riots in Brixton, the riots in Toxteth, etc. There was an incredible period of sort of looking inwards. And, you know, I was lucky to grow up to spend a long time living in Tulse Hill, Blockwell Park, multicultural before Brixton became gentrified, going clubbing during the 90s, you know, just after sort of the 80s, Summer of Love, etc. And it didn't seem to matter to us, you know, what we know, as long as you were on the dance floor, you know, that was the main thing. Why haven't these lessons been carried on? Or were we just in a little sort of elite bubble, do you think?
So first of all, I want to acknowledge that some things have got better, but if you look around, things have improved. If you go back, you know, even to the 70s or 80s, the idea of having Rishi Sunak as prime minister would have been unthinkable. You know, you wouldn't have an Asian prime minister. And I know that Kamala Harris in the US didn't succeed in her presidential bid, but the idea of a black woman taken seriously as a presidential candidate, that would have been unheard of 30 years ago. Or I keep forgetting, the 70s aren't 30 years ago. They're more like 50.
Yeah, worrying, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, but that would have been unheard of back then. And so we can't pretend we haven't made progress. But I think part of the problem is that many people think that things have been fixed. They think that we did some marches, we did some protests, and now everything's fine. And they think, yes, there's still some problems. But you'd be shocked at the number of people, even really well-meaning people, who think that the reason we have wealth disparities now, or the reason why white students perform better at universities now, or the reason why there's a dearth of people in certain highly qualified positions, a dearth of people of color in highly qualified positions, is because of historical issues. And they're not. People don't realize how much this is because of present day issues, current issues, racism happening now. Not that, oh, they're the first generation, oh, their parents didn't have the skills. No, when they perform exactly as well as the white students, when they do exactly the same behaviors, when they make exactly the same great accomplishments and exactly the same mistakes, they're not treated the same way. And we know that that's true. And most people don't know that that's true.
Is there perhaps a default setting that you know, white Caucasians go to? And what I'm thinking of now is, because people would say, well, look how far we've come. You know, look at for example, the England football team, the male's football team. And you know, that is a total representation. We can't possibly be racist. And okay, you got a point there. But yeah, when England lost, of course, on penalties to that booze-fueled Euro football finals, there was shocking racism online. I mean, there were people being sort of handed custodial sentences for it. And that goes to show when pack mentality takes over and the barriers are let down, be it fueled by alcohol or whatever, that certain people will resort to stereotypes.
Well, I think the problem is actually deeper than that, because I want to appreciate the glorious diversity of the British football teams. That's fantastic. But I always think the argument that, oh, we can't be racist because look at how diverse our footballers are, or look at, you know, how well we treated this or that ethnic minority. To me, that always rings a little hollow. It's a bit like a serial killer saying, I couldn't possibly be a serial killer. Look, this person is alive. I'm like, but that's not how being a serial killer works. It doesn't mean you're doing it every day, all the time, to everyone. It's just that you're doing it often enough that it's clearly a societal problem. And the same is true about racism. You can, for example, marry a black person if you want to. And some people do this while maintaining stern beliefs about the inferiority of black people's intelligence or the greater likelihood of criminality. You can have an Indian partner or an Indian boss, and you can really like that person while still fundamentally thinking that they're untrustworthy or unimaginative or culturally alien or that they don't belong. These are things people can do. And the idea that just because we're not being racist in one area, we aren't reliably and predictably doing racist things in other areas, that's just not true.
I mean, how important though is the profile? Because, you know, obviously we talk about young black males and it's, I mean, we see in the States, don't we, these horrendous situations taking place where young black males are collecting for charity in some neighborhood and it escalates out of control. And the next thing, we've got a tragic story on our hands. But I'm just thinking, because of the way that the media likes to go to stereotypes and the music industry loves to go to stereotypes, so that when I look at bands that I was getting into in my youth, like, you know, De La Soul, all, you know, all that sort of stuff, you know, the flower rap of the early 90s and stuff like that, and now the music industry, it's easier and lazier and more profitable to portray young black males as dangerous, threatening, you know, driving Lamborghinis with, excuse my language, hose in the back. And that's a vicious circle, and it just perpetuates the stereotyping. And then you get people not only believing the stereotype, but you have people from those ethnic groups behaving like the stereotype because they just go, oh, fine, if you're going to put me in this category, I will act as I'm in this category.
Yes, I would say that the media, you know, they have to take some of the blame. They're doing things wrong. When you look at media, you can see that ethnic minorities are overrepresented doing bad things and underrepresented doing good things. There are a couple of really great studies that I do mention in the book that just look at the prevalence of crime. So let's say in the UK, white people make up, let's say, 82% of the population. And, you know, let's say they commit about 80% of the crimes. Let's say that they do. But when you watch the news, what you actually find is you only see white people committing about 40% of the crimes. And that excess is made up by people of color being shown on the news committing more crimes than they actually do in real life. Now, I'm making up those numbers. Please do read the book, because I don't remember all the numbers off the top of my head. So I want you to go read the book and get the actual numbers correct. But this is a reliable pattern. And the media will show us people behaving in ways that they don't. The number of times that you'll see a really great example I also cite in the book, most people cannot name a single children's book in which there is a black father who's taking care of a child. And that's not because we don't exist. I am a black father and I've taken care of my children. I've carried them up and down parks and I've sat them on my shoulder and tried to burp them until they've vomited all over my clothes. And I've had to repeatedly wash my hair as I was covered in baby sick. These are experiences I have, but not experiences that you will ever find in most children's books. Most people can't name a single one. And so the media is definitely to blame in part. But also, I think people don't realize how dangerous these stereotypes are and the effect that they have. It does make me think of another study that I talked about in the book, in which they put police officers and members of the public, and this is in the US where people have guns more often, and they put them in a video game. And the point of the video game was to shoot the people who had guns and not to shoot the people who didn't have guns. And some of the time, the people were white and some of the time they were black. So you could have white guy with a gun, white guy, no gun, black guy with a gun, black guy, no gun. And what the researchers were interested in were the mistakes that people would make. And predictably, you can probably see where this is going, they'd make a certain set of mistakes much more frequently than others. They were much more likely to fail to shoot a white person with a gun, to just let him off, because they didn't want to shoot him. They didn't see him as threatening enough. And to mistakenly shoot a black person who was holding a wallet or a can opener or something perfectly innocuous. And when you run experiments like this, you can see the way that these things affect our thinking and our responses. Now, thankfully, in the UK, most people don't walk around with guns. But in the US, people do have guns. They genuinely have guns. And people also have wallets and can openers. And if this is a mistake people are likely to make, you can understand why these terrible things keep happening, why this perception of threat and these stereotypes lead to people who are just minding their own business being hurt quite a lot of the time.
Can you argue that the African American experience is different to the Afro-Caribbean experience? Or are British white people pulling the wool over their eyes and saying, oh, well, it's different for us because we didn't have the same amount of slavery, and the Windrush generation were kind of invited here, so that makes our situation different?
I would say that it's different everywhere. So I've lived in four countries. I lived in Jamaica, France, the US, and the UK. And being black is different in every single one of those countries. I would say, for me personally, best experience by a long shot, Jamaica, obviously, because we're majority black over there. That's just fantastic. But I would say second for me is France, actually. And then after that, you get the UK and the US. But I would say that's just my experience. You don't care about my experience. What you actually care about is the data and the research. And they show that, yes, the experience differs country to country. And I know that British people really do like to say, oh, that's an American problem. That's not a problem we have here. But if you run the same studies in the US and the UK, you get essentially the same results. So if you have, you know, CV studies and you have white names on CVs and black names on CVs and you distribute them, the white people get more callbacks and more money. That happens in the US, that happens in the UK, that happens in France. True everywhere.
Very good friend of mine ran a call center. He was a sales director and he was from Sri Lanka. So his second name was Sivaraja. And he had been educated at Wellington. And so when he went on the phone, he called himself Charles Blake. And if he ever tried to sell as Mr. Sivaraja, he wouldn't get the phone call through. But when he sold as Charles Blake with the British accent, straight through. And it was wonderful. And I'm using this with my, you know, to go to trade shows with him and watch people double take when they met Charles Blake. And just, that just goes to show it's not something that you would think, but you automatically think, don't you? See a name on a CV or you hear an accent on the phone and you think you've already got a picture in your mind. That's just cultural conditioning. And that is hundreds of years, Keon. How on earth are we going to be able to change that?
I don't want to change that part. I want people to hear the name Keon West and I want them to picture a black person with dreadlocks. I'm really fine with that, actually. That part I'm really okay with. The part I don't want them to do is to then offer me fewer jobs and less money because they pictured a black guy with dreadlocks. So I think it would be great if your friend, you know, when he was on the telephone, could give people his actual name and they could imagine the most Sri Lankan person possible. You did say Sri Lankan, didn't you?
That's what you said. Yeah,
if they imagine the most Sri Lankan person possible, that would be great. But then they went on to treat him as well as they would treat everybody else. So I actually think it's fantastic. Picture people as black or as Indian or as Chinese as you want. Fantastic. Just don't offer us fewer jobs for the same qualifications. Don't offer us less money for the same work. Don't put us in prison for the same. Don't put us in prison more often for the same evidence. Don't treat us worse when we do the same things. That's the part I want people to stop doing.
What was the spark behind this book then? What was the bit that what sort of flashed across your radar and thought, right, this is I've got to write something. I've got to use the data to put this work out.
I wouldn't say there was one spark. There was a growing, building sense of frustration and of urgency. And it's that you talk to people, for example. You'd be surprised at the number of people who would say, oh, well, the problem is just that the ethnic minorities aren't doing the right things. This is a conversation that continued to happen most of my life. I don't know if you know about this. You probably do. But there is the achievement gap that exists in almost all British universities in which white students outperform ethnic minority students. And every now and then they get in a bit of a political hullabaloo about this and they think, oh, how can we solve it? And these are intelligent people. You know, these are people with PhDs who are well acquainted with students and are supposed to be on the student side. And you would be shocked at how often all the solutions are in making the students behave differently or do better. The problem here is clearly the ethnic minority students who aren't doing the right things. And the problem is never, I have never heard people spontaneously say, maybe the problem is us. Maybe the problem is how we're responding to them, how we're teaching them, how we're grading them. But do you know what? The research shows that the problem is probably us. When you look at a number of studies, what they do is they take, for example, essays, and they're exactly the same essay, and they make a couple hundred copies of the essay, but they put white names at the top of some and black names or Indian names at the top of others, and they send them out. And when they do, they find that the ones with the ethnic minority names at the top get lower grades, even though they're exactly the same essay. And research like this is never discussed when people are trying to figure out what's going on. So yeah, I think the issues are very deep, and people just aren't recognizing where the problem is coming from.
You know, only last week we have a US president saying he's going to get rid of diversity. That's out. I'm conducting this interview now, and I can just picture some people just shouting at the radio going, this is, and I'm going to drop the W bomb on us, and I know it's Monday, this is wokeism. This is woke, this is what is wrong, quote unquote, with the world today, and it's all profiling, and it's all, the world's gone mad and slamming down their headsets.
Well, I'd say two things. If scientific reality is wokeism, and if that bothers you, I think you have a much bigger problem than politics. I think you have a basic problem of perceiving reality. And I'm not here to tell people what their politics should be. You can be left-wing, right-wing, you can be, you know, hyper-libertarian or hyper-communist. But I think whatever you are, it's worth your time to know the reality of what's happening. And if a woke person does the experiment where they have 100 essays and half of them have white names and half of them have black names, they'll get the same result as if a non-woke person does it. A lot of things don't change depending on your politics. And that includes stuff like this. It includes gravity. It includes the shape of the world. It's just good to know what the science says. And then you can do whatever you want with that, as long as you know what the science says. So I can see that. And the second thing is, I can understand some of the people who are really behind Donald Trump's thing, because they say, oh, we don't want all these ethnic minorities to get the edge. We want meritocracy. But what they don't realize is that they're not getting meritocracy. Meritocracy is the opposite of what you're getting now. What you're getting now, and what we know you're getting now, is a situation in which white people are getting more offers, more money, better treatment for exactly the same behavior. That is a scientific fact. That's the opposite of meritocracy. So if you want meritocracy, you have to do something about it. And if all you're doing is getting rid of DEI, what you're doing is guaranteeing you're not going to get that meritocracy. Now, maybe you're fine with that, but if you want to do something about it, you have to actually do something about it.
Are there any glimmers of light, of you know, positive notes on this? Because we don't want this to leave everybody on a downer on a Monday morning. You know, there's some examples where it is going right, or some glimmers of hope. Because, you know, you work with young people, you lecture, you know, you've got a better grip on this than I have sitting in a studio in southern Spain.
Yes. What I would say is there's more than a glimmer of hope. I'd say there's an incredible, overwhelming tsunami of hope. I think someone asked me the other day, could we solve this with AI? And I said, lady, we could solve this with pen and paper. We don't need AI. We have known how to do this for 70 years. We've known exactly how racism works. We've known what happens with it. We've known how to get it to go away. We've known how to mitigate its effects, even when it doesn't go away. The solutions to it have existed for decades. We just don't do them. We just don't want to do them. We don't have the political will to apply them. And so the book does make it really clear, if we really wanted to get rid of this, we already know how to do it. It's just most people don't realize there's a problem. And then most people don't want to apply the solutions that actually work. But we have them, and we've had them for a long time.
The book is called The Science of Racism, Everything You Need to Know But Probably Don't Yet. It's by Keon West, who is speaking today. If people want to find you online, where's the best place to find you?
I just say Google Prof Keon West, and then that will bring up all my socials. I am still, I just haven't brought myself yet to delete my profile on X, so you'll still find me there. You'll find me on LinkedIn or on Instagram, although Instagram, I don't know why you'd want to see pictures of me, but if you do, it's the same handle, and that's probably the easiest place to start.
Just to prove that you have cleaned the dreadlocks since your little ones were sick on them several years ago and that sort of thing. You can also, listeners, order the book via our own virtual bookstore. The book is called The Science of Racism. It's by Professor Keon West. Thank you so much for your time today.
Great. Thank you for having me.